This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Evan Wasuka and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia, where we'll be taking a look at the big stories from across the Pacific region over the past week. Coming up on today's show, the Prime Ministers of Australia and Papua New Guinea walk the Kokoda Trail, commemorating the lives lost in battle. It's lobbying time in Honiara as political groups outdo each other to form Solomon Islands' next government. And the repatriation of bones and skeletons from Germany to Palau begins. We'll have more on those stories coming up. We start in Papua New Guinea, where the Prime Ministers of Australia and PNG took part in an Anzac Dawn service in the town of Isurava. The service marked the end of a two-day trek along the infamous Kokoda Trail, where the two Prime Ministers paid tribute to the lives lost on the battlefields of the Second World War. The ABC's Melissa Clark walked the trail and filed this report.
The Kokoda Track is known for being arduous. The steep hills, the humidity and the mud make trekking here a serious undertaking. Over 2 days, Anthony Albanese and James Marape have walked together, taking time to catch their breath, talk and remember the soldiers who walked this track 82 years ago in a devastating wartime battle to push back the advancing Japanese soldiers.
What we have done over the past couple of days is get just a small insight of the courage and resilience.
From village to village, the arrival of two prime ministers has been heralded.
And don't you stay with us.
And after a final push, the leaders reach the Isurava Memorial Site, meeting the Australians and Papuans who've gathered here for an Anzac Day dawn service. A crescendo to a journey.
The journey up was hard. It's not easy, not a walk in the park, so to speak, in any case. But what we're doing today symbolises that we can't take the present for granted. We too must plant our own memories, the memories of democracy, respecting each other, caring for each other.
We walk together today and into the future as well.
This journey has cemented the personal relationship between the two leaders. And for the Australian government, having Papua New Guinea as a firm and reliable partner is a reassurance in a world of uncertainty.
The ABC's Melissa Clark reporting from the Kokoda Trail in Papua New Guinea. The Battle of Kokoda is among the most celebrated Australian victories of the Second World War, when Australian soldiers, helped by Papua New Guinean villagers, repelled Japanese advance on Port Moresby along a rugged mountain trail. But 88 years on, there's concerns about the state of the track, that it has declined in recent years, and now, as you're about to hear, there's a push to bring it under new management.
Many a lad will see their mothers and husbands, their wee ones and wives, just because the Fuzzy Wuzzies carried them out and saved their lives.
For three decades, Charlie Lin has led trekkers across the rugged 96-kilometre Kokoda Trail. But after his 101st trip last year, he decided enough was enough.
It's in the worst condition it's ever been in the 32 years I've trekked across it. Now, there are areas along the Brown River that are potential death traps. You'd hardly call it a track. It's about 10 metres above the river. Anybody's traveling that at night, a misstep or something, they go in with their pack on, you will never find them again.
The son of a World War II veteran, Lin led one of the first Australian tourist groups across the famous track on the 50th anniversary of the battle in 1992. Since then, it's become a popular tourist experience and an important source of income for local villagers, bringing in $20 million Australian dollars annually to PNG's economy. But over the years, Mr. Lin says management of the trail has declined, and the tourism experience has suffered because of it.
There's not one decent toilet across the trail for them. I can't book a campsite. So what you have, you'll have two or three groups, you know, with probably up to 50, 60 people arriving at a campsite that's got a capacity for, say, 20, 25, and they'll be having heated arguments on who's staying there that night.
Mr. Lin says tourist numbers have dropped close to 50% since 2008, a figure that's backed up by a 2022 study by the University of the South Pacific. But other trekking operators aren't as critical. Mick O'Malley has been a guide for 18 years. He says the track's administrative body, the Kokoda Track Authority, is doing the best with what it's got.
We're bloody head and shoulders above where we used to be when I first started trekking. I agree with Charlie in regards to, you know, that it'd be great to have amazing toilets and all that sort of stuff. But by the same token, when you go camping in Australia and you go to a campground, the government don't run the campground. It's all private enterprise. It's not the government's responsibility to make sure the toilets and guest houses are clean and up to standard.
Regardless, a push is now underway to place the Kokoda Track Authority under a new government agency and improve its capabilities.
When the Kokoda Track Authority was established under the Special Purpose Authority with the Department of Provincial and Local Level Government, it was essentially parked in the wrong place. It should have been parked with PNG Tourism Promotion Authority because Kokoda Trail Trekking is a tourism asset.
That's Andy Abel, the Deputy Chairman of the PNG Tourism Promotion Authority.
It's like parking a semi-trailer in a sedan car park. So when I started to realise the gravity of the situation and how the Tourism Authority was spending millions of kina promoting Kokoda Trail in Australia, but we had no control over it because it was parked in the wrong department, I made it my business to then try and to correct this.
Andy is spearheading a push to shift the management rights of the Kokoda Track Authority from the Department of Local Level Government to the PNG Tourism Promotion Authority, and he expects it to be approved within 3 months.
I've met with the Minister for Department of Provincial Local Level Government. I've met with the Minister for Tourism. I've met with the Prime Minister. So it's now just a matter of time, not when, for the National Executive Council submission to go before Cabinet, and the transfer should take place.
In the meantime, he has teamed up with Port Moresby Governor Pauz Parkop. Together, they have signed a Memorandum of Understanding with Canada Bay Council in Sydney and the Australian not-for-profit Network Kokoda. Governor Parkop says the group hopes to fund improvements to the trail and install various other wartime attractions around Port Moresby.
The plan is to develop these sites all the way from Paga Hill in Port Moresby all the way to Buna and Sananada and those villages down at the coast of Oro Province. So it becomes a full war memorial site. And the plan on the part of our city and Tourist Promotion Authority is to encourage and promote tourism in the area of war pilgrimage.
That's not all. He wants to extend the tourism market beyond Australia.
I think the potential for us to get more numbers here, more than Gallipoli, is there. But, you know, we as a country and as government too, has not really developed and harnessed this potential to create the environment or to create the facilities by which more Australians can come. And, of course, the bigger with the Japanese and the USA. The Japanese, we want to invite them to come too so they can tell their story, you know, their version of things. They also come and pay respect to their lost loved ones.
Mr. Lin says only a small percentage of people are physically able to trek the Kokoda Trail. So by creating more wartime attractions, PNG could expand its tourism demographic by tenfold.
There's an older cohort who are fascinated, again, by the military history and also the cultural history of Papua New Guinea, our closest neighbour, who would love to go there. But they've got to be able to see something. They've got to be able to interpret something. Historical marker points, you know, where a small tourism bus can pull in so that people understand the significance of the site. But the big draw card is Owers Corner. People stepped off to go to war, and many of them didn't come back. I believe it should be developed as a visitor centre, which has a library and a coffee shop, all those sort of things.
Charlie Lin ending that report from Kyle Evans, and the ABC has reached out to the Kokoda Track Authority for comment. An intense period of political horse trading is about to get underway in Solomon Islands after none of the parties emerged from last week's election strong enough to form a government on their own. The incumbent pro-Chinese Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare leads a crowded pack, even though his party lost more than half of its seats. From Honiara, here's the ABC Solomon Islands reporter, Chris and Rita Amonu-Leong.
On the streets in Solomon Islands' capital, Honiara, there's one question on everyone's mind. So who do you think will be the country's next prime minister?
I like Gordon Dasi, Lilo. I want him to become a prime minister.
Me, Junior Peter Ken Lorena should be our next prime minister for Solomon Islands.
After a week of counting, all 50 seats in Solomon Islands national election have been declared. No party has gained a clear majority, but caretaker Prime Minister Manasi Songavare has emerged with 15 seats, the largest number. But that's half of the 37 seats his party had coming into the election.
Obviously, there is a big, big interest by the world, because there have been a number of decisions that have not gone down well within the international community, especially the Western allies, led by the United States of America, Australia, New Zealand.
Mr. Songavare has led Solomon Islands through 5 years of rapid change, most notably pulling the country closer towards China. As competition for influence in the Pacific region intensifies, it has meant the election is being closely watched by Australia and the superpowers. In an interview with local media, Mr. Songavare even went as far as to accuse the United States of interfering in the election in his home province, claiming the U.S. Embassy promised to pay the school fees of people who voted for his rival.
United States of America.
I'm going to write to the United States of America, the U.S. Embassy. Our people, the people who voted for me, we won. They're saying, let them pay for these voters. You look after us.
Today marks the start of an intense negotiation period that could take weeks, with parties and independents horse trading to try and build a coalition and form government. And it's a crowded pack, with opposition leader Matthew Wale and Peter Kenilore Jr., the son of the country's first prime minister, seen as possible potential rivals to Mr. Songavare. Both men have committed to review the country's pivot towards China. Yet one man, former Prime Minister Gordon Dasi Lilo, has emerged as a dark horse after returning to Parliament.
I have been Prime Minister before. I was never selfish about it. I love this country and I want this country to progress more.
Election watchers say last week's elections was clean and peaceful. But the negotiation process to build government has historically seen accusations of corruption and under-the-table payments. Veteran journalist Dorothy Wickham says surprises are expected.
There were already certain MPs being seen at certain camps that didn't belong there before. So I think that there's already some movement. With the elections for the Prime Minister, it's secret ballot. You can just swing anywhere at the last minute.
11 independent MPs were elected and they're expected to play a crucial role in forming government.
Solomon Islands reporter Chris and Rita Almanu-Leong with that story. And the U.S. Embassy in Solomon Islands has been contacted for comment about Mr. Songavare's claims. You're listening to Pacific Review on ABC Radio Australia. Communities in Palau are eagerly awaiting the remains of their ancestors who were held in German institutions for over a century. The remains were taken without the community's knowledge and were kept in museums and a university in Germany. Dubravka Volodea took a look into this story.
Sitting on shelves in storage rooms, boxes containing human skulls had been kept in darkness for years. Eight of those remains held in the boxes at the University of Göttingen and State Ethnographic Collections of Saxony have been handed over to their descendants from Palau. Göttingen University's president, Professor Metin Tolan, spoke at the handover ceremony in his city.
Please accept our apologies for what was done to your ancestors.
Leontine Meyer van Mensch from the State Ethnographic Collections of Saxony also spoke.
Today we are gathered in the spirit of humanity. Today we are gathered because we as university and museum collection need to take responsibility for the wrongdoings in the past. We are gathered in the painful truth that we should have needed together and that we as institutions and the responsible political bodies have taken too much time to take that responsibility.
The skulls came to Germany in colonial times, but until recently, the descendants did not know they were there.
When I first heard about it, I was really shocked because I just couldn't wrap my head around the fact that people were brought there. When we got there, I was also surprised at how apologetic most of the people were, because this was like over 100 years ago.
Ripka Kintaro is a representative of the Puluana Council in Palau who attended the ceremony. Four of her ancestors were taken.
When I actually stood up and did the whole chant, it was, I got so emotional. I didn't even realize it. And I was shocked at myself too. I hope that at least they are now at peace, just and that we could bring them back home.
She says there was no knowledge in her community about what had happened about 100 years ago.
And so there was never any, no idea whatsoever, or even like a hint that such things could have happened or did happen, nothing.
A couple of years ago, Palauan McMichael Mutok Jr. went to Germany on a fellowship to learn what was in the boxes. Not much was known about the skulls, where they exactly came from, or how exactly they got to Europe. But he's since learned more.
It's of our ancestor remains has a number that's written on the skulls that actually associated with the index cards. And the index cards mentioned about Palau. So there were, you would say, a journal entry written by Dr. Paul Hambrook, who visited Palau in 1908. And he's one of the explorer who joined with Dr. Augustin Kramer on the South Seas expedition. And on his journals, he actually mentioned about collecting human remains in Palau.
And they were obviously stolen remains.
Yeah, it was written exactly on his journals that he went there secretly just to excavate the remains.
The skulls were later used in race research, an outdated and now condemned practice. Mr. Mutok says it's Palau's first repatriation of human remains from colonial times. He's since been contacted by some other German museums and an institution in the United States who also have remains from Palau. Professor of Cultural Anthropology at the University of Göttingen, Regina Bendix, says there's a big push in Germany to deal with its colonial past.
There's a really big sea change in being able to talk with concerned communities, being able to exchange information, trying to work together to make it possible to restitute if the interest is there.
This was the university's third repatriation to the Pacific. Earlier, they held ceremonies for Hawaiian as well as Maori and Moriroi remains. While scientists know that the remains are from Palau, they will for the first time use DNA technology to see if they can find any direct living descendants.
Measuring skulls is, of course, this horrible historical, you know, the phrenology, the effort to come to race science in the 19th century. But the DNA is, of course, an opportunity.
The remains will go on a journey across the world to their home soon. Ripka Kintaro says they will be welcomed by their communities.
To have them back and giving them a proper burial is very important to us. It's really, it's all woven into everything that identifies us as people of Puluana and then Palau.
They are expected to arrive next month, and the Palau government plans to erect a memorial at their burial site.
And that report from Dubravka Volodya. U.S. President Joe Biden's claim that his uncle was eaten by cannibals in Papua New Guinea during World War II has sparked anger in PNG. Last week, during a visit to a war memorial in his hometown, President Biden paid tribute to his uncle, Ambrose Finnegan, who died in a plane crash in PNG in 1944. He's quoted as saying his body was never found because he got shot down in an area where there were a lot of cannibals. President Biden's mentioned the story many times before, but never the claim of cannibalism. And US military records show his uncle's plane crashed into the ocean. PNG Prime Minister James Marape responded diplomatically to the comments, saying his country did not deserve to be labelled cannibals. He also urged people not to get worked up over those comments.
Sometimes you have loose words. I've met him more than four occasions today, and every time I've met him, he's always had a warm regards to Papua New Guinea.
Meanwhile, Dr. Henry Ivarature from the Australia Pacific Security College says the comments are poorly timed given the tussle between the US and China for influence in the region. He backs Mr. Marape for the US to find the remains of its citizens who died in PNG during the war and to repatriate them.
I think it's a very unfortunate statement, given the geopolitics that is playing in this part of the region. Mr. Biden is president of one of the largest superpowers in the world, and who is also courting partnership in the Pacific, has to be very careful about making such sensational remarks. Yeah, whether it's proven or otherwise, it's just got to be very sensitive. It appears to be a kind of off-the-cuff comment, but Mr. Biden is known to have made such kind of allegations before. So it's not an unusual comment.
What are your thoughts on that word cannibalism, which the president has allegedly said?
I think it's a bit derogatory. It's very insensitive. You know, Papua New Guineans have become educated, have been civilized, we've advanced so much. And that's off the past. I think it just means that we're backward. Our culture is still backward. But that's not the truth. The truth is that Pacific Islanders, including Papua New Guineans, have become educated and are very advanced. They have become Christians. They have become very forward-looking, open-minded people. Yeah, so to describe them as cannibals, that's probably in the past, but that doesn't happen in this day and age.
The Prime Minister, James Marape, said that Papua New Guinea didn't ask for the war to be played out in PNG and also in the region, so maybe there should be some kind of respect should be shown here to the people.
Yeah, not only didn't they ask for the war, but there's so many unexploded ordinances that are found all over the Pacific, and they should have cleaned up the Pacific from those dangerous unexploded ordinances, which are actually causing casualties and killing many innocent Pacific Islanders from Solomon Islands all the way up to Palau. Yeah, so I think the Prime Minister has made a very, very valid point, not just clean up your remains of your soldiers, but also all the war wreck that's littered the Pacific. Oils are leaking from ships that have been sunk, and they pose a great danger to the security and the environment of a Pacific Island environment.
At this point, there have been so much talk about geopolitics in the region. So does President Biden's comment help at all or not?
Geopolitics in the Pacific is actually very, very heightened at this moment in time. A lot of US, Australia, New Zealand, everybody's interested in making sure that they are allied with Pacific Island countries. And comments like this can be very, you know, can put off those kind of developments that have been built by those countries to build very good relationship with countries like PNG and other Pacific Island states. So, unfortunately, Mr. Biden is not thinking beyond, or his comments may also contribute to the way Papua New Guinea might see the United States. I think it's just a very poor and poorly timed comment from Mr. Biden. He should have understood the sensitive nature of those comments and the sensitivities around geopolitics at play in this part of the region.
Dr. Henry Ivarature from the Australian National University, and he was speaking there to the ABC's Caroline Tiriman. And that's it from Pacific Review. I'm Evan Wasuka. Thank you for listening, and do join us again at the same time next week for more news and views from across the Pacific region. Pacific Review is produced on the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation.